And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here with me, as he is most Fridays. We're continuing with today's Year in Review theme, and we're doing it Back Talk style. So, hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Well, few stories this year captured the attention of the world, like the BP oil spill. Now, the deadly explosion of an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico back in April was said to be the largest of its kind and led to one of the biggest environmental disasters in U.S. history. And back in July, we checked in with Mike Frenette. He lives in Venice, Louisiana, which was in the path of the oil spill. And there he owns the Redfish Lodge and operates a charter boat company. Here's what he told us then.
It took me 29 years to get the business to the level that it's in now. And our industry is a very strong industry. We've developed this to be the number one sport fishing destination in the country, one of the top five in the world. And we basically are zeroed out right now.
And we heard from Mike again the other day just to check in. And, Michelle, sadly, recovery has been slow.
For the most part, we're basically starting all over again. We're trying to let people know it's okay to come fishing, but you know, the perception still is very bleak around the country, and all of our business comes from out-of-state customers. I mean, obviously, there may come a point where I'm going to have to make some decisions, some changes, but who knows? You can't let it keep you down, because if you do, then you're in serious trouble.
Well, thank you, Mike. We appreciate your staying in touch with us. Please do hang in there. Lee, many people might remember a conversation we had in October on the challenges facing ex-offenders and their families as they try to reenter society. Back then, we introduced listeners to Eugene Nelson. He's a Milwaukee man who served more than 20 years in prison for sexual assault. He talked about his experiences of trying to find a job and trying to shake the stigma of being a threat to society, even though he's finished his sentence. This is what he had to say back then.
You can't make a split judgment just based on saying someone was incarcerated for a sexual offense or someone was incarcerated for this offense. For me, it was discouraging being able to go back out into the workforce and be denied an opportunity.
Now, Lee, we have good news to report about Eugene Nelson. He graduated with honors last week with a degree in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's been accepted to the graduate program at the university, and he starts work on his master's in just a few weeks.
Congrats, Eugene. And Michelle, as far as the economy goes, one word sums up the hardship faced by so many Americans in 2010, jobs, or rather the lack thereof. And back in August, we explained how the unemployment rate for black men was disproportionately higher than that of their white counterparts. And in case you're wondering, the current numbers haven't changed all that much. 16% for black men now and 9% for white men. And in our conversation about that disparity, we introduced listeners to Suleiman Harris. He's black in his late 20s and lives here in the Washington, D.C. area. And although he held a bachelor's degree in engineering and a master's in information technology, what he did not have at the time was a job. Here he is back in August.
Even though I have the book knowledge, I lack the work experience. But how can I get the work experience if no one's willing to give me a chance?
Well, things have also turned around for Suleiman. I gave him a call this week, Michelle, and he filled me in.
I have great news. I've been employed for a little over 2 months now. I'm currently working as a project manager on a construction project, and it's supposed to be a 6-year project, so it looks like I'll be employed for quite some time.
We are very happy for you. Good for you, Suleiman. Lee, anything else?
Well, just one thing. In October, we reported on the case of the Scott sisters. The Mississippi siblings, Jamie and Gladys, were convicted in 1994 for their part in an armed robbery, which made them $11 richer. A jury imposed 2 life sentences on the women for luring 2 men down a road where they were then robbed by 3 others. Now, the other 3 pleaded guilty and were only sentenced to 10 months. The Scott sisters' case prompted national cries of injustice. Well, Wednesday, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour suspended the prison terms for the women. He released an order that reads, quote, "The Mississippi Department of Corrections believes the sisters no longer pose a threat to society," end quote. However, one condition of release for Gladys Scott, she has to donate a kidney to her sister Jamie, who is on daily dialysis.
Willie, thank you for all those updates. And you know what? Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. Or you can go to npr.org, click on programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out. We'll just ahead, as we get ready to pop the bubbly and celebrate a new year, the Barbershop Guys look back at the most controversial, the most redunculous, the most surprising events of the past year.
Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids are more organized than the Tea Party, man.
I wouldn't say that. You will find that out in November.
A New Year's Barbershop review of Shape Up's past, present, and future. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
What would the holidays be without good food? Christmas ham, sugar cookies, gingerbread, champagne on New Year's Eve, then black-eyed peas and collard greens on New Year's Day. We heard about some of the mouth-watering fare last week, but this week we've asked you to tell us about the other kind, the stomach-churning kind, those dreaded dishes that return to the table year after year after year. James Farwell of Fairfield, Connecticut writes, "My sister-in-law makes a jello mold with suspended mandarin oranges with a special twist. The mold she uses makes an impression of a Christmas tree on top, which she fills with mayonnaise."
I'm Donna Ellery of McIndoe Falls, Vermont, and I can only tell you this now because my grandmother is dead. Every Christmas, my children and I, we would receive at least one of these huge loaves of candied fruit bread. Everything was in that bread. We couldn't understand why they were so heavy. They were so heavy. They were unedible. They were so heavy. You didn't dare to want to eat one.
One thing Gregory Blue of Chester Springs, Pennsylvania doesn't dare eat anymore, rouladen. His wife makes it every year, supposedly from a family recipe brought over from the old country. Blue writes, "It begins with what always seemed to me as an overpriced piece of beef, thinly sliced and cured so as to render it dried. You then slice a carrot stick and quarter a dill pickle so that the two pieces are approximately the same size." Blue goes on to tell us, "The beef is rolled up with the carrot and the pickle inside, along with a slice of bacon, and toothpicks keep the wraps together. And then into the crock pot they go." He continues, "You add enough canned golden mushroom soup to cover all the wraps and hide the flavor of the beef in the event that the pickle juice and bacon would not already accomplish that goal. You let them slow cook in the crock pot until the meat becomes unrecognizable and turns to mush." Gregory Blue concludes, "I have yet to decide whether this recipe has been modernized or that my wife's family actually believes that 18th century Europe had access to canned golden mushroom soup, toothpicks, and crock pots."
Well, you know, it probably wasn't until the third consecutive year we had lutefisk for Christmas that I realized the Vikings sailed icy oceans not in search of riches and conquest, but rather for decent food.
That's John Anderson of Washington, D.C., with his bad holiday food.
Lutefisk is a dried white fish soaked in lye, and as a song goes, "O lutefisk, it looks like glue and tastes like a shoe." By the time we had it for a fourth consecutive Christmas, I asked everyone in the family at the dinner table if anyone really liked it. Even my grandfather, a diehard Swede, and for whom the dish was prepared, a man who once ate carp and liked it, confessed to having trouble getting past the third bite. That same year, my mother had been in contact with a distant relative in Osteracker, and she asked what they did to make lutefisk more enjoyable. She learned that since refrigerators became widely accessible, hardly anyone in Sweden ate lutefisk. I believe the combination of the two revelations that year prevented the meal from finding its way onto the dinner table a fifth year.
"You smell so strong, you look like glue, you taste just like an overshoe. But lutefisk come Saturday, I think I'll eat you anyway."
That's a trio of anonymous young ladies from YouTube performing that classic sing-along, "O Lutefisk." Thank you for sending in your bad holiday food stories. We did enjoy them in a stinky cheese kind of way.
"Remember on Christmas Eve how we'd receive our big treat of December. It wasn't turkey or fried ham, it wasn't even pickled ham. My mother knew there was no risk in serving buttered lutefisk."
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. Investors actually have something to sing about as they ring in the new year tonight. Stock prices are up in 2010. The Dow Industrial Average gained 11% this year, and the S&P 500 gained 13%. That's a broader measure of overall market performance. So after some rockier times, that's some good news for the economy, a sign of rebound in action. But there are also those scarier signs, a weak job market, and the European banking crisis, just to name two. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Lizanne Saunders has been looking on the bright side for a long time. Saunders is chief market strategist at Charles Schwab, and she's been seeing signs of a turnaround for a while.
In the spring of 2009, I felt very strongly that I had to apologize for optimism because it was certainly not a very popular position to have.
Even though the economy was flat on its back, Saunders was urging investors to stay the course. To make big money in the market, she said, you have to come in when most people are feeling scared, when no one can see the recovery coming. This year, Saunders has had her optimism tested again. For the first few months of the year, stocks did well. Then everything changed.
Violence on the streets of Athens as anger over harsh economic cutbacks boiled over. Three people died when protesters firebombed a bank, a symbolic target in Greece's troubled times.
Countries such as Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, which had borrowed heavily during the boom, were having trouble paying their debts. A lot of big banks had lent money to these countries, and for a time it seemed like the second wave of the banking crisis that had brought down Lehman Brothers. David Kelly is chief market strategist at JP Morgan Funds.
The fear was that if one of these sovereign countries was to default, the banking system in Europe and the banking system around the world would take it on the chin again.
On May 6th, in the middle of the crisis, came the flash crash, when the Dow fell more than 600 points in a few minutes. It was the kind of event that seared itself into the nervous systems of traders.
Here comes Morgan Stanley to sell. Morgan Stanley comes in and sells 100 cars.
This recording of Chicago futures trader Ben Lichtenstein responding to the crash became a hit on YouTube.
Guys, once again, 75 even offer here now, guys. 70 even offer. 69 trade.
The flash crash would later be blamed on an unusual trade by a mutual fund company that set off a fierce round of computer-driven selling. The market rebounded as quickly as it fell, and soon, David Kelly says, European governments organized a bailout that eased the banking crisis.
I think that really reassured a lot of investors, and they've had doubts since then, but every time people have doubted what European governments were going to do, they've been very resolute in saying, we are going to make sure that nobody defaults here.
In the months since then, there have been slow but steady signs that the economy is rebounding, that the job market is still weak. The Federal Reserve embarked on a controversial program of quantitative easing, buying up government securities to stimulate the economy. All that seems to have persuaded investors that the rebound is for real. Stocks have been steadily rising. But David Kelly says the wild swings of the past few years have left investors cautious.
It's funny, a few years ago, everybody was asking me, what are the hot areas in markets? And now nobody wants a hot area for fear they're going to eventually get burned.
Among the stocks that are rising the fastest are technology and consumer companies. Lizanne Saunders says she still believes investors are underestimating the strength of the recovery.
I don't have an expectation that we're going to have a boom in 2011, but I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised relative to what are still fairly subdued expectations.
So has it become a little easier to be an optimist?
I feel like I no longer have to apologize for for my optimism, and that has taken a while.
Saunders says at some point investor sentiment will turn more positive. She says that may be the time when the financial markets are overheating again, and investors should think about pulling out. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Time now for a Morning Edition tradition, commentator John Ridley's year-end take on the scandals that left him wondering, why all the fuss?
They seemed so important at the time, didn't they? The Facebook-worthy scandals and the tweet-level gossip that actually made social media seem relevant. But as we turn the page on another year, and while we try to figure out how we explain to our grandchildren why we allowed Snooki to happen, let's take a look back on some of the top controversies of 2010. Meg Whitman's housekeeper drama. Wait, someone in California unwittingly hired an undocumented worker? Both myself and my pool guy, Pedro, were shocked to hear this. By the way, how do you know when something is a controversy? When Gloria Allred shows up. The Park 51 Mosque, because we all know the only things that should be respectfully close to ground zero are souvenir stands and fast food joints. Christine O'Donnell having to declare, "I am not a witch." Remember the good old days when a political scandal was having a baby out of wedlock with your videographer? The outing of Shirley Sherrod. It's going to be a long time before anybody gets excited by the phrase, "I've got a video that's going to blow the lid off the Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Agency." Juan Williams versus National Public Radio. Come on, NPR. In post-racial America, black people should be allowed to be Islamophobes, too. The Cam Newton pay-for-play allegations. Learning a lesson from their lax handling of the Reggie Bush affair, this time the NCAA proactively did nothing about potential recruiting violations in college football. Seriously, the NCAA couldn't do less if they started installing players-only ATMs in the team training rooms. But all those non-issues can't begin to not measure up to the biggest controversy of 2010, the iPhone death grip. The word going around, allegedly, if you held an iPhone 4 a certain way, you sometimes maybe kind of get a little bit slightly less reception. Possibly. Apple haters were so excited by AntennaGate, they completely forgot to go out and buy themselves a Microsoft Kinphone, which lived and died in 7 anonymous weeks. But don't cry in your HP slates, haters. Hopefully next year there'll be an iPad 2.0 with a minor screen discoloration issue for you all to flame on your blog sites with an already cliche cry of epic fail. I look forward to it. But until then, here's hoping your 2011 is filled with nothing but significance.
John Ridley is a screenwriter and editor of ThatMinorityThing.com. College bowl season is upon us. Actually, it's all around us. 35 games in 24 days, culminating in the national championship game on January 10th. Before we get there, though, we are allowed to glory in the wonder that is the Meineke Bowl, the Chick-fil-A Bowl, and, of course, the Beef O'Brady's Bowl. NPR's Mike Pesca is here to discuss what he's seen so far and what's coming up. Good morning, Mike.
Beef O'Brady's. Hello.
It sounds really good, huh? I'm rubbing my hands.
Delectable bowl game.
Where do these bowls come from? I mean, why so many bowls?
They come from the need to generate profits. Now, most of the bowls are, I think all of the bowls actually, are incorporated as nonprofit corporations. But the people who run the bowls make quite a bit of money, and they generate quite a bit of income. The people who are paying this are the people who are going to the bowls, the fans and spectators. But schools really have to pay a pretty hefty bill at times to go to these bowl games. For instance, the University of Connecticut was invited to a bowl this year because they won the Big East, and they were tasked with buying up 17,500 tickets. Well, they can only sell about 4,000. So they're on the hook for what could be millions of dollars. They charge the band to sit in the stadium and perform at halftime. They sometimes charge the mascot. The defenders of the bowls will say, well, it's like Mardi Gras, and there's a party every week, and it culminates in Fat Tuesday. I find it's a little like the political season after the nomination's been sewn up, when we know who the candidate's going to be and you have to play out the string of primaries. You know, let's get to the main contest already.
Well, there are some really good bowls. Tell us about some of the best.
Well, you know, the Beef O'Brady's Bowl was actually a pretty great game, and the Little Caesars Bowl this year featured an exciting finish, and it was between two teams, Toledo and Florida International, that if they had been playing on just a regular Saturday in October, that game would not have been televised outside of Northwest Ohio. It wouldn't even probably have been televised in Miami, where Florida International is. So every once in a while, a good, exciting game comes through and focuses the light on teams you wouldn't otherwise watch, or a matchup you wouldn't get, two teams that have never played, that sort of thing.
And what about the low points?
Going into the season, one of the most disappointing things to college football fans was that Boise State lost its final game, and that meant they wouldn't be having an undefeated season. And there was a chance that tiny Boise was going to be able to play a big, huge school. But because they lost that game, they were shuttled out, and they were forced to play Utah. The final score was 26-3. It was a very boring bowl game. And the other, not such a great game, but really weird thing happened when Georgia Tech played Air Force. Air Force has this Falcon who flies into the stadium to start a game, but something went awry and he flew out of the stadium and just wound up wandering the streets and the ledges of Shreveport. They did find him later and they explained that he's supposed to be hungry enough to fly to the bait, but maybe he was munching on too many mice the day before. Boring bowl game, lost Falcon, adds up to an unexciting event.
And what games, Mike, should we be paying attention to in these coming days?
Well, the national championship game, for sure. That's January 10th, Oregon versus Auburn. But there are some other games, and one really interesting one, I think, might be on New Year's Day, the Rose Bowl, what they call the granddaddy of them all. That'll pit Wisconsin against Texas Christian University, one of those smaller schools, Texas Christian, against a big boy, Wisconsin. If they beat Wisconsin, I think people could give all the small schools a little bit more credit.
NPR's Mike Pesca, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And here's one more note from the world of college sports. The longest winning streak in Division I college basketball history is over. The Connecticut women's team, which had won 90 in a row, lost last night to Stanford, 71-59.